Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. First, I want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I also want to tell you about what's coming up in July. Our team at Responsive want to invite you to participate in 6 hours of online CFRE-approved training. I am talking about a soup-to-nuts fundraising philosophy that will ensure your organization is ready for the road ahead. No one on the planet is going to offer you tools as researched, as tested, and as sustainable as our four frameworks. If you'd like more information about partnering with OneCause or more information about our upcoming webinar series, look for information in the show notes. After you do, shoot me an email and let me know that you did. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Lindsay. Delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. I'm particularly interested in catching up with you because I know you're involved with AFP St. Louis, and I know we're talking about having some engagement with you folks here in the fall. And I also know that you've connected with us. We were going to talk about some of the things that's going on at your organization. Before we dive into the sort of the big topic of our chat, why don't you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Lindsay Reichart. As Jason mentioned, I am the president of AFP St. Louis chapter here in St. Louis, Missouri. We just found out the other day that we are the 12th largest chapter right now. We have around 400 members. And then in my day job, I serve as the senior development director for the Oasis Institute. Oasis is a nationwide nonprofit that supports healthy aging through lifelong learning, health and exercise, and volunteer programs for older adults.
So I would not have guessed that. I think I've been through St. Louis on a couple of occasions, but I would not have guessed that you guys would have such a large AFP chapter. Why is that? Why is there 400? Are you all rock stars recruiters, or do you have lots of charities, or somewhere in between?
All of the above.
Okay.
You know, St. Louis is one of the most philanthropic cities per capita in the country. So in terms of givers, but also we do have a large number of nonprofits here. And, you know, we span people in spanning the geographic area. So we hit some people in Illinois, some people in St. Charles County, which may not seem far away, but if you're in St. Louis, it's a big deal to cross the bridge. So we try to serve people on both bridges in Missouri and in Illinois.
So I have to imagine, I think this is kind of the path that we're going to go down today. I have to imagine that COVID-19 and the fact that everybody had to retreat to their homes and get behind Zoom and all this sort of web-based technology that we're using to keep ourselves connected. I have to imagine that that was a pretty big deal for you all.
Yes. In terms of AFP, we have shifted all of our programming virtually. So we've got... we've just made the decision to move our conference to virtual. Normally, it's a one-day conference in person. We have about 300 people, and we're going to be doing that all online now, which isn't as ideal as we would have hoped. But I think there's a lot of opportunities in the virtual world to bring some new ideas to the table and do things that we haven't been able to do before. So we're, interestingly enough, too, even before COVID, our theme for the conference was Back to the Future, Looking Ahead with 2020 Vision. And it was all about taking these concepts and principles that were tried and true, and then also mixing those up with trendy type things that would take us into the future. And I think a lot of us in the fundraising field have seen that play out. It really is getting back to the basics in terms of stewarding our donors and staying in touch and communicating with them, letting them know what's going on in our nonprofit organizations. And so the silver lining, I guess, is that this theme we think is even more applicable now than it was before the COVID outbreak.
You know, you just, Lindsay, you and I are so in sync. You did take the words out of my mouth. I was about to say that we were going to have a conversation about sort of the silver lining and sort of all this, both for your AFP chapter as well as for your organization. So what do you think, sort of at a very, very big high level, because that's what we talked about before we hit the record button. What is sort of the silver lining for AFP in terms of, and maybe we can even talk about this in sort of the global context, because there's a lot of my listeners are AFP members, and they're probably, even our friends in Washington are probably thinking about sort of what's the silver lining in all this. But what does it mean for an organization that's a membership organization? You know, I think 6,000 or 8,000 members strong, something like that. What do you think it means for them?
You know, I think for AFP and membership organizations in particular, it gives us an opportunity to look at things a little bit differently. AFP Global has really made a big focus on shifting. They're still offering all of the same programming that they were, just doing it in a different way and making their virtual offerings more front and center on their website. And so there are a lot of tools that AFP Global has. And I think they just created a new case for support, actually. And I think they've done a good job demonstrating that now more than ever, AFP members need to be a part of the organization for networking potential, for keeping sharp on professional development, and using some of the resources and benefits that AFP has. So for example, recently, about a year ago, we announced a formal partnership with the American Association on University Women. And we have a negotiation workshop that all members can take part in for free. So whether that's salary negotiation or kind of major gift negotiation or sales pitches, things like that. So that's definitely needed. And then we have a partnership with Korn Ferry too, where you can upload your resume. You can use an app on your phone where they will do virtual trainings and things like that. So it's given AFP an opportunity to emphasize some of the things that they already had in place that maybe were not quite as front and center before that seem more pertinent to members now. And on that note too, a lot of online tools are available. I've seen a lot of chapters connecting. So again, since I'm the chapter president for AFP St. Louis, I spend a lot of time on phone calls where AFP has allowed, you know, chapter presidents of this like size chapters to get together, or telling us how what they've been learning from how they've been shifting things virtually. They've kind of been ahead of the curve and then sharing all of those learnings with their members. And then there's also something called AFP Connect, which is kind of like an online hub discussion board. And that's been a great way to connect with people even outside of St. Louis. And so if you're an AFP member and you haven't had an opportunity to hop on there yet, I'd highly encourage you to take a chance and get on there and kind of see who you can connect with and what you might be able to learn.
So I don't think I've wrestled sort of with this question myself or with a guest, but so I know AFP had launched, I want to say it was 2 years ago, maybe it was more sooner than that, but this AFP Women's Initiative, and it was the idea of sort of addressing some very specific, concerns that were relative to women. Do you think that in the midst of sort of this transit, we call it a transition for lack of any other better word. Do you think in the midst of this transition that'll sort of impede, or do you think that'll actually help them advance those initiatives?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
You don't know. Do you? Yeah. Yeah. You haven't contemplated it either.
I haven't contemplated it, but I was very fortunate last October to go to Phoenix to the AFP Lead and Women's Summit. And it was really fantastic. They talked about the AAUW training. They talked about the pay gap between men and women. And I am hopeful that I think this will help advance women in their careers and just different ways of working in general. You know, I think that this has proven to a lot of people that work from home or working remotely is a more viable option. This is kind of a stereotype, but just generally speaking, sometimes women have more caregiving responsibilities or may have to halt their career while they're raising their children. And I think this COVID opportunity of everybody working from home or having flexible work schedules in some ways can advance women in the field, showing that the average workday doesn't have to look like an average workday. You know, people can be more flexible about how they get things done, and we can still accomplish what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I was reading something the other day. I don't recall what it was. You and I are both unprepared for the question I decided to stir us up with here very early in the process. But it was kind of the notion that some of the diversity, equity, and inclusion issues may be able to sort of advance themselves because some of those stereotypes that some of those ways that we hinge our stereotypes, some of the things that our stereotypes are hinged on, we won't be able to get away with as quickly, for example. So for instance, when I walk in a room differently than you, you know, everybody sees a white male, for example. And so, whereas they're going to see you as a female. And so some of those stereotypes don't obviously make themselves sort of manifest and as evident there. And so we're going to have to start relying on more discernment and more probably better things than just making these sort of sweeping generalizations about what it means when a guy walks in the room versus somebody else. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And I think, you know, there are kind of two sides to that. I think there's definitely that side. Also, our idea, Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access chair for our chapter is legally blind. And she has told us that these virtual meetings have been really great for her because typically she has to catch an Uber to go to AFP board meetings or to meetings with donors and clients. And now her having the ability to take all of these things from her computer has been nice. On the other side of that, though, I'm sure you've heard a lot about the digital divide and people not having access to devices and the internet, which sometimes tends to happen along socioeconomic or racial lines. And so I think there's kind of the other side to that coin, where in some ways it's advancing the ideas of inclusion, diversity, equity, and access. And in other areas, it's kind of helping us see where we're lacking in terms of being able to help people when everybody has to work virtually.
Yeah, it's that notion of being what's the word? It's digital literacy, I think, is sometimes what we sometimes hear that reference to. It's sort of that ability to sort of get on this laptop, for example, and sort of operate and function and communicate and sort of all of that, all of sort of the necessities there. So when you think about the last, what's it been, 10, 12 weeks, maybe it hadn't been quite that long, and what AFP has done, you've obviously gone to a sort of a virtual format, but what sort of things have you been able to accomplish that have sort of been like, wow, we just did that sort of things?
You know, I think the wow, we just did that is more around being able to think differently about our programming and include other people. So for example, for our June program, we have the former chapter president of AFP New Jersey who's speaking. Before, that wouldn't have really been feasible for us because we didn't have in our budget to pay speaker fees or travel. And so I think it's really helping us kind of diversify who we're bringing to the table in terms of speaking and presenting for AFP. Sure. And helping us kind of cross promote and involve with other chapters. For example, I just got off on this morning with the chapter administrator for AFP in Austin, Texas, because they're going to be doing their conference online too. And so we've been swapping ideas and kind of sharing what we're doing. And again, that all was available to us before, but I think it's kind of forcing our hand to say, okay, nobody here needs to recreate the wheel. And if somebody else is doing something really great, like let's share ideas and see how we can work with each other to get the most bang for our buck and maximize what we're doing.
Yeah, our team here at Responsive did a webinar, a series of webinars, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And it was very, the engagement amongst our team, so we'll call that sort of the speaker lineup, if you will, I would like to think was probably as engaging as it would have been if we were in person. And I think we probably, in terms of numbers and people who actually stuck around and actually attended the webinar and came to multiple sessions and such, I think we probably had three times as many people there as we would have originally expected. And so I think that's some of that silver lining that we're sort of talking about, is that we might be able to, as a result of sort of learning new skills and habits and being able to sort of create additional accessibility,
consequently be able to reach much broader audiences. I had a guest on here, I don't know, right after everything sort of started to sort of fall down on us, sort of loom down on us, as she was an organization in Boston, and they increased the number of people that attended their virtual event was like 20% more people than they would have anticipated at the actual event that obviously had to be canceled. So what are the things you're learning at your organization? We've talked a lot about AFP and the chapter, but what are you learning at the organization you work for? And let's not miss the opportunity for you to tell us about the organization as well.
Sure. So, as I mentioned earlier, Oasis is nationwide, but we're headquartered here in St. Louis. And so typically pre-COVID, we would offer lifelong learning classes ranging everywhere from history to current events to technology to cooking. We had health and exercise programs. It's particularly a bunch of evidence-based programs around falls prevention and chronic disease self-management, which are definitely high-risk issues for older adults. And then we actually had volunteer opportunities both in our offices across the country, and perhaps our most well-known program is the Oasis Intergenerational Tutoring Program, where we pair trained older adult volunteer tutors with kids in grades kindergarten through third grade who are struggling to read. And so across the country, we have about 5,000 older adult volunteer tutors. And, with the class goers and the exercises, since we serve a particularly vulnerable audience, we were really early on the train of saying, we don't feel like it's safe to meet in person. And so we've been having to pivot all of our programs online. And that's been really interesting, both in terms of doing it and in terms of engaging our participants. So I had mentioned a little bit before this call when we were chatting, our average participant at Oasis is 72 to 73 years old. So not only were we pivoting our programs online, but we were doing a lot of training with these older adults. And one really interesting thing to me has been a lot of people who were really hesitant to do anything online before, even as much as like make a donation to Oasis with their credit card or to check out a video, once they were almost forced to because of COVID, now they've been really active and engaged online, which is really, I think, inspiring, because a lot of people, I think, write off older adults as saying, oh, they don't know how to use technology, or they're not savvy with this, they're not going to know how to use it. And we've kind of seen the exact opposite. We've seen people really embracing it. But also for those older adults who don't want to or can't afford to use the internet or computer, we've taken a lot of our programs to phone-based groups. And that's been really popular as well. So we've done that piece for like our direct programming. And then obviously with the tutoring, all the schools that closed, we're not able to get into schools and tutor, but we felt that it was still important for us to stay in touch with our tutors. And so on a weekly basis, we're sending out a Tutor Tuesday email that includes professional development opportunities, videos with read-alongs, information or session plans about phonics, so that our tutors can keep sharp and keep their skills up in this interim time when they're not able to be with their students.
So I think the term you use, the idea of getting sort of back to basics, and it's interesting to think about our world becoming so much more virtual and web-based, and sort of combine that with the notion of getting back to basics. So when you put those two and two together, what are we really talking about there?
Well, in terms of programming, I think there's a couple of different things. In fundraising, I think it means something a little bit different than in programming, but I think, customer service and really making sure we're taking care of our people and the customer's experience has always been important, but I think it's more important than ever now. And in some cases and in some ways, we have more time to focus on it maybe than we did before, because we're not distracted by so many other things. But for us at Oasis, the key thing that we have always strived to do is bring older adults together. And you've probably heard a lot of the statistics that have come out in the last couple of years about social isolation and loneliness being just as detrimental to people's health as obesity and smoking. And so even before social isolation was a buzzword, and long before COVID, the work that we've been trying to do is keep older adults active and healthy as they age. And so Now you're starting to see a lot of stuff come out about the effects of social isolation, and a lot of people of a lot of ages are now experiencing social isolation or depression or mental health issues from kind of being on their own. And that's what our programs are always strive to do, is the opposite, like bring people out of that and make sure that they're active and healthy. So that part of our mission is still the same. We're going back to the basics in terms of making sure that we're keeping people active and engaged. And how that looks is a little bit different. It's, you know, it's not in person now. It's via Zoom classes and via things online. But again, I think it's helping people kind of learn new technologies along the way, and then also helping them stay active and engaged. And something I'm really excited about is, I just had to look down at the calendar date. Actually, next week, we are launching something called Oasis Everywhere. Right now, Oasis is in about 250 communities across the country with some variation of our programs or another, but we only have 9 full service education centers that offer everything. Well, next week we're launching Oasis Everywhere, which will give people across the country the opportunity to log on and take part in Oasis classes, even if there's not an Oasis center in their town, or if they are in a place where there is an Oasis center, they can still take classes virtually. And I think moving forward, we will still have this hybrid model, even once it's safe to move back to in-person classes, because people like to have options. And particularly for the older adult population we serve, a lot of times people can't come to classes because they have a change in their health status or a change in their mobility status. They may not be able to drive, they may have to caretake for someone in their family. So this is still going to give them the opportunity to take classes from Oasis centers all over the country from the comfort of their own home. So that's something that we are super excited about launching here in the next couple of weeks.
So I have to imagine if I'm hearing you, I mean, yeah, definitely what I'm hearing. So essentially, part of the silver lining for you all is that your case for support has essentially expanded. You have a broader, greater impact as a result of the COVID sort of reality that you're actually expanding to on a national scale, and COVID has essentially been the impetus or sort of that momentum builder that sort of compelled you to go out and do that.
Yeah, that's correct. It's something we've wanted to do for a while. We've been contemplating it for 4 or 5 years. We had a small grant several years ago that kind of allowed us to buy microphones and certain recording equipment and stuff. But that project never really took off. But it was always something in the back of our minds and something that our current leadership was really excited about. And so even as early as earlier this year before COVID, we had submitted a funding request that got declined. And our CEO said, you know what, we're going to do this anyway. We're going to find a way to do it. And then COVID happened. And, you know, internally, we were able to figure out that we could do it on a technology platform and a shopping cart platform that we already had. We just had to look at it a little bit differently. So again, it was a push for us too, to say, you know, extra funding will be great. And we certainly will apply for that. But we have the opportunity to use technology that we already have to launch this and get this off the ground.
So what about fundraising? So how has your fundraising efforts at Oasis evolved? Have they changed? Are they getting back to basics? Are you experimenting with new things? What does that look like?
So Oasis, it has a really interesting funding history. We initially were almost exclusively funded by Macy's and May Company, and actually had physical locations in Macy's stores across the country. So back in our heyday, we didn't really have the need to fundraise. We had a lot of our corporate support provided by May Company. Yeah. Right. As times changed, we have shifted a little bit more. I think in the year 2000 is when we started doing individual fundraising. But with a small and scrappy team, direct mail was really our only form of individual fundraising. And the rest of our revenue was made up from grants, and then about a third of it from earned revenue from these classes that we offer. So a number of the lifelong learning and exercise classes are free of charge because they're sponsored, but there's also a subset that are priced competitively within the market. And so that's a big source of revenue for Oasis as well. And so when we had to suspend all these in-person classes and cancel, you know, we reached out to all of our participants and donors, and actually had a fair number of them turn their fee into a donation to us, which was really lovely. But we've just been, we've been very forthright and honest with our funders and our participants about what we need, and what we're still doing to be there. And I think one of the most effective things that we've done is we created a COVID-19 response two-pager that outlines on the front side here in St. Louis what we're doing in response to COVID, and then on the backside how we're supporting our National Oasis Network. And we were very proactive about sending that to all of our grant funders. We've been fortunate to have the opportunity to convert a lot of our project-specific support to general operating support. And, you know, a lot of family foundations have been really gracious about saying, we realize you're not going to meet your objectives, and either giving a grant extension or allowing the opportunity to revise those. But I think one of the neatest things for us has been on the individual donor front. It has really given us time to focus on that outside of the direct mail appeal, which I had mentioned was previously really the only way we were doing it. I hired a development director who started in December, and you know, people are at home now, so they have a lot more time to talk on the phone and to tell you about their lives and what's going on. And, you know, we are still asking for money, and that's still mainly through the direct mail appeal. But a lot of what we've been doing is just, again, back to the basics of stewardship and just calling our donors and checking in on them and saying, how are you? And how has COVID affected your life and your family? And just staying in touch with them and letting them know, again, here's what we're doing at Oasis. We saw approximately X loss in revenue from classes, but here's how we've pivoted what we're doing, and we hope you'll support us. And interestingly, you know, a lot of these calls that weren't asks, we've been getting checks in the mail. I entered a gift the other day that was from someone who had been a lapsed donor since 1995. And so I think it's what we're seeing at Oasis is a higher number of givers at a lower giving amount. And we're also seeing a lot of our lapsed and then what we consider long lapsed donors, which for us is longer than 36 months, who are coming back and making a gift to Oasis during this time.
Now, is that because of the, do you think that's because of the timing and sort of where the world is right now? Or do you think it's perhaps those phone, are those the same people that are getting those phone calls from your development director, or is there something else?
You know, I think it's a mixture of both. The phone calls and the handwritten notes are happening for a higher level of donor for us. But what we've had the opportunity to do now is even with a $5 or $10 donor, after their gift is made, making an immediate thank you phone call and checking in on them. You know, interestingly, for us, kind of our, for Oasis, a major gift is $1,000, which I realize is maybe small for some other organizations, but we haven't seen as many gifts in that area, but we've seen a ton of like $25 and $50 gifts. We've seen a lot of people increase from that $50 to $100 range. And, you know, my theory that's unsupported by anything except a guess that I'm making is that those donors that are giving to us may not have had as much of their giving impacted by market fluctuations as some of our higher level donors.
Do you think, you know, I'm hearing you describe the work with your development director. And one of the things that's occurred to me a number of times as I'm talking to individuals like yourself is that some of these newer, younger, so think about the newer, somebody at the AFP chapter who's, you know, 18 months into their first fundraising job. I think perhaps one of the things that we're going to see on the other side of this is that fundraising professionals will have developed an appreciation and a comfort level back on the telephone that they did not, that they maybe have been lacking for, say, the last decade. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Yeah. And I think that's true. So we were, AFP was actually hosting a kind of a social hour. We do that every couple of weeks now, have virtual social hours for anybody who wants to hop on. And we had a couple of people talking about how it's difficult for them to make ask via the phone when they're used to being able to be in front of somebody and, you know, reading their verbal cues and kind of taking a look at their posture and how, you know, you can't see that over the phone. Of the people that were in this particular group, nobody had made an ask over Zoom yet, but some people were just starting to do like get to know you calls. And, I think it is going to make people more comfortable with doing it. The term somebody used, which I thought was was apropos, but interesting, was dialing for dollars. She said, right. I don't like dialing for dollars, but I think it is going to get people used to it. But another comment somebody made was, this is actually giving me more time, because instead of having, you know, an hour and a half lunch with somebody and driving to lunch and driving back, like, it's giving me the opportunity to engage with more people in the same amount of time.
Yeah, I tend to think that we're going to see, so if we sort of sit on the notion of there's going to be more fundraisers talking to more donors now over the telephone, and the efficiency that's going to come with that is sort of just a bonus to that. I think on the backside of this, part of the silver lining is the idea that you're going to have a fundraiser who has heard the donor's voice, you know, on a micro and macro level in much more meaningful ways. And so therefore, whether they're writing that, appeal letter at Christmas time, or whether they're working on a special event, or whether they're doing it a major gift call with another donor, they're going to be so much more sensitive and aware and empathetic with sort of who their donor happens to be. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think, you know, the other thing that keeps me up at night, and I know this sounds silly because we're in the middle of everything that's going on right now, and I'm certainly thinking about that, but I'm also thinking about when things get back to quote unquote normal, how do we translate all of these things that we've been doing during this time, and make sure that we are still giving our donors the level of service that they've been used to having from us during this time? Because I know for us at Oasis, and a lot of my friends at other organizations, we are spending extra time with our donors and they are getting more attention. And do we keep that up? Can we keep that up? And how do we balance that with, again, quote unquote, business as usual as things return to a more normal level? So I think we are hearing their voices, and I hope that people remember how organizations treated and interacted with them during COVID. But I also am thinking about how do we translate this so it's not like a one and done kind of thing for this special global pandemic. And then once it's over, you know, people aren't getting as much attention from us, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, but it also leads me to think that a moment ago, you sort of apologized for the idea that your organization's your organization's major gift is $1,000, for example. I said, Lindsay, I was speaking to an audience in Chicago back, I think it was in September or October of October of last year. And we didn't even know, we didn't see COVID-19 coming then, right? I said to that audience, I said that in my opinion, as the baby boomers become the sort of the predominant mid-level and major donor, their average gift sizes are going to go down and their expectations for that gift are going to go up. And I think we're going to see more. And I told I said, it's going to ruffle some serious feathers and shake up some apple carts when we have to buy a cup of coffee with a donor to close a $500 gift. And I think perhaps that's where we're going. I don't think we have to be necessarily sitting in front of people. I think Zoom is going to become or similar platforms are going to become remarkably powerful. But I think we're going to have just as meaningful conversations in order to close that $1,000 major gift that your organization is closing. Mm-hmm. Because I think we have so exaggerated. I think our field has so exaggerated what size of a gift necessitates a meaningful conversation. And then the byproduct of that is there's not enough fundraisers who've experienced those meaningful conversations just as being part of the joy of what it is we do.
Yes, I agree with you.
Like, I think your development director, that new development director, because you've had him or her on the telephone for the last several months and they've done what they're going to do, that person's actually going to be a better fundraiser and they're actually going to stick around longer and they're actually going to raise more money for you because they actually have enjoyed the direct interaction over the telephone or over Zoom that a lot of fundraisers for the last 5 years weren't required to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I, you know, we're also thinking in terms of every time she is talking to a donor or if they send in a little note on their gift or things that we may not have prioritized following up on before, we're getting some really great stories that we're able to share, you know, on our blog and in our e-blast and in our annual report. And so it's a good, and that's a good practice in development anyways, to always get stories and share them. But I think this has given us an opportunity to dig a little deeper and get some more information that we can then, you know, get feedback on and use in a variety of avenues to really tell our nonprofit story in a stronger way.
Is she, if you don't mind me asking, is this her first fundraising role?
It's not, but she's still fairly new to the field.
Okay,
she's years out of college. Yeah.
Right. So she's totally teachable, shapeable, moldable. If you think about that, that's the fundraiser that 10 years from now, right? If not 5 years from now, as long as you can keep her happy, maybe 10 years from now, that's the fundraiser of the future. And so she is going to lead an organization and raise money for an organization with a greater appreciation for that meaningful engagement that I think a lot of us who are in leadership roles now have been able to effectively avoid. And so if there's anything that I've been advocating for, anybody who listens to the podcast regularly, it's that we've got to learn how to pick up that phone, have those meaningful conversations. You know, obviously, you know, in the COVID sort of period of the time in the world, we've got to learn how to do that virtually. But I think those meaningful conversations are just so important.
Well, I think they are. And, you know, it's so much easier or more tempting to just shoot off an email, but it's so much more meaningful to have a phone conversation. And, you know, some of the people we're calling aren't home, but we are leaving messages and then we're hearing back from them like, oh, I got your call. I was, you know, at the grocery store or my grandkid was over or whatever. And so I think people just like knowing that we're checking in on them and thinking about them, even if we're not.
You think they're calling you back with greater regularity than they maybe were before?
Yes, for sure. Definitely.
Maybe it's because we all know that we're fearful. You know, who calls a fundraiser back because they think you're going to ask for money? But even on the chance that that person on the other end, you know, the donor on the other side, at least they know that you can't ask them for a meeting and take them out to lunch and then ask them for money. So they're not quite as guarded. I mean, if you think about it, we're just in this sort of this more, we're not as guarded.
Right.
Is perhaps because I keep hearing that. I keep hearing that message over and over again that my donors are calling back. I had somebody on here recently that said, you know, somebody reached out to me. You know, I called them three times. They called back and they gave a gift, you know, unrequested. It wasn't even asked for. And so there's a greater appreciation for what it is that we do as fundraisers coming from the donor who oftentimes we think is very guarded and hesitant to talk to us.
Yeah. And I think, again, us just being open and vulnerable, you know, you don't want to do like a whole sky is falling bit, but if you can say, you know, here's the programs that here's how we've shifted what we're doing. But look, since we had to cancel all these in-person classes, this cost us a $300,000 projected, you know, revenue deficit at the end of the year. And I think if people can put real numbers and stories to what is happening and how it's affecting the nonprofit, it's given us a chance to be a little more vulnerable with our donors too. And I think that has allowed them to kind of see us more as people in our programs for what they're truly doing versus this transactional relationship that can sometimes happen with fundraising.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. Yeah. Lindsay, I have had your attention for 35 minutes, and sometimes we start losing listeners at about that point. If somebody's listening to our conversation, they would like to reach out to you and continue the conversation. Maybe they're in the St. Louis area and interested in joining the AFP chapter there. What's your suggestion on how they reach out to you?
Sure. I'd love to share that. So if you are interested in AFP information, definitely check out our website. It's afpstl.org. Or if anybody wants to email me, I am happy to answer any questions or connect with you on LinkedIn. It's Lindsay Reichart. My email is lreichart, R-E-I-C-H-A-R-D-T at oasisnet.org. So I look forward to connecting with you.
Yeah, and I will be certain to put information about the local chapter in the show notes, as well as linking your LinkedIn profile so people can reach out to you that way as well. Thank you, Lindsay. It has certainly been a pleasure. I do look forward to the day when I can be in the room with you, buy a cup of coffee for you or something. In the meantime, it's certainly been a pleasure, and you're always welcome back.
Thank you, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.